to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasadaya Gautama Sri Madhavata Vedanta Swami Vati Namaste Namaste Saraswati Devaya Gauravani Vachami Saraswati Satari Monday Nam Sri Guru Sri Natapa Nam Sri Guru Nam Vaishnava Namaste Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahadina Ravalakam Bhikam Tam Sidhantam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Vajitam Sahitam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Bhutrashtra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Demigods and their father. Especially their father, I think I'm saying. Purport.
As soon as a Brahmana takes birth, he assumes three kinds of debts. Debts to the great saints, debts to the demigods, and debts to his father. The son of a Brahmana must undergo celibacy, brahmacharya, to clear his debts to the saintly persons. He must perform, I'm going to ask you what are these three and what do you do? He must perform ritualistic ceremonies to clear his debts to the demigods, and he must beget children to become free from his debts to his father. Prajapati Daksha argued that although the renounced order is recommended for liberation, in other words, it's a good thing. So Prajapati Daksha said, yes, renunciation is a good thing. We like renunciation. One cannot attain liberation unless one fulfills his obligations to the demigods, the saints, and his father. Since Daksha's sons had not liberated themselves from these three debts, how could Narada Muni have led them to the renounced order of life? That sound logical? Right? If you haven't finished your third year of school, how can you go on to your fourth year of school? Right? That reasonable? No. Apparently, Prajapati Daksha did not know the final decision of the Shastras. So, was he giving a Shastric argument?
Yes.
Yes. Definitely. Was what he was saying true? Yes. Was it completely true? No. Apparently, Prajapati Daksha did not know the final decision of the Shastra, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.5.41. I guess he didn't read that far. He got stuck here in the sixth canto and then right up to the 11th canto. Devarshi Bhutapta Nirnam Pitrinam Nakim Kuro Nayam Rinicha Rajan Savatmanaya Sharanam Sharanyam Katom Mukundam Parihichikartam. Everyone is indebted to the demigods, to living entities in general, to his family, to the pitas, and so on. But if one fully surrenders to Krishna, Mukunda, partially surrenders? What did it say? Fully. Who can give one liberation, even if one performs no yajnas, one is free from all debts. Even if one does not repay his debts, he is free from all debts if he renounces the material world for the sake of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose lotus feet are the shelter of everyone. This is the verdict of the Shastra. Therefore, Narada Muni was completely right in instructing the sons of Prajapati Daksha to renounce this material world immediately and take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unfortunately, Prajapati Daksha, the father of the Hayashas and Sabalashas, did not understand the great service rendered by Narada Muni. Daksha therefore addressed him as Papa, the personality of sinful activities. Where some, that means some, what does Papa mean in Spanish? Father or potato? Father. And how do you say potato? Papa?
Papa.
I knew that if you change the accent, one means father and one means potato. Just like in English, if you say desert or dessert, depending on where you put the accent. So once there was a French-born devotee who was saying how the scientists think the moon is a big dessert. I was thinking, she mean like a cheesecake? So I'm sure I'm pronouncing some of the Sanskrit wrong, and those of you from Indian background, please excuse me if it sounds like I was saying potato, but I'm supposed to be saying father. Anyway, he called him Papa, the personality of sinful activities, an asadhu, a non-saintly person. That was in the previous verse. Since Narada Muni was a great saint in Vaishnava, he tolerated all such accusations from Prajapati Daksha. He merely performed his duty as a Vaishnava by delivering all the sons of Prajapati Daksha, enabling them to return home back to Godhead. Rinash Chabir Amutanam Amimam Sitakarmanam Vigata Shreya Sahapapa Lokayor Ubayor Vata. Lokayor Ubayor means what? Two worlds. So the two worlds are this life and next life. They won't be happy this life, they won't be happy next life. And Shreya means? Auspiciousness. And what kind of auspiciousness? Short term or long term? Long term. I'll tell you how I remember that, the Prayas and the Shreyas. I think of Prayas like playing, and Prabhupada says like children like to play, but their father sends them to school. So Prayas is the short-term benefit, Shreyas is long-term benefit. And he's saying they won't get any long-term benefit out of this. Lokayor Ubayor, not in this life or in the next life, because they're not ready yet. They haven't finished yet. For Japani Daksha said, my sons were not all freed from their three debts. Indeed, they did not properly consider their obligations. O Narayani, O personality of sinful action, you have obstructed their progress toward good fortune in this world and the next, because they are still indebted to the saintly persons, the demigods, and their father. So, today I'm going to talk about debt. But I think before I talk about debt, I just want to look at something at the end of this purport. And that is where Narada Muni is called a papa, a sinful person, and he's called the previous verse an asadu, and the previous verse he really gets insulted in so many ways. But he tolerates everything. And Daksha is, I mean, he's a devotee. After all, he saw Lord Vishnu face to face. He's not an ordinary devotee. And he experienced bhava upon seeing Lord Vishnu. I was just reading in Bhagavatam yesterday, Prabhupada was talking about the symptoms of bhava in relationship to the heart being melted on hearing the holy name. And he talked about steady bhava. So obviously, Daksha had a little glimpse of bhava, but he didn't steadily stay on that platform. Anyway, he's a devotee and he's doing the business of the Lord. In fact, he's doing the service that's given to him by the Lord. And as far as he can see, Narada Muni is interfering with that service. That's from his perspective. You ever have any service to do and somebody gets in your way? Maybe somebody ruins it? When I first was starting to take up Krishna consciousness, I was in university and I decided that I was going to make prasadam for everybody. So first thing I did was make ghee. And of course you don't need to refrigerate ghee, so I left it in the dormitory kitchen and the cleaning lady threw it out. And I, as a poor university student, I couldn't afford to buy more butter to make more ghee. So I think that that's kind of how Daksha felt, right? Here I'm training up these children, first 10,000 and then 1,000. That was a big responsibility. I'm training up these children. I'm supposed to populate the universe with good population to please Lord Vishnu. And here this guy comes along and says, you know, there's a rotating wheel, there's a hole from which nobody returns, there's an unchaste woman, and what are you doing? Kimasatpan Birgavet, what are you doing in just fruitive activities? And they said, oh, you're right, let's go. Bye-bye. And then he thought, okay, I'll tolerate this, I'll try again. Like I might have said, okay, I'll make more ghee, you know? He makes produces 1,000 children, then Narada Muni says, go follow the path of your brothers. Gone. You know, what are you doing interfering with my service, you sinful, unsaintly person dressed like a sadhu? So sometimes we might feel like speaking like this to other devotees. Hopefully you don't ever do it. Maybe you've done it sometime. But at least sometimes we might feel like speaking like this to other devotees. And I know that sometimes people do talk like this to other devotees. Have you ever heard a devotee talk like this to another devotee? Anybody ever heard that? I have. I've seen it in writing lots of times. Lots and lots and lots of times. You're not really following Prabhupada. You're a demon dressed like a devotee. And the higher up you go in ISKCON in terms of your position, the more you're likely to be the target of that kind of talk. So what do we find Narada? Did he tolerate it? Actually, we explained that he tolerated this because he was thinking, let him get rid of his anger and then maybe I can preach to him. That was his feeling. He didn't take it personally. So our Prabhupada says the preacher has to be very tolerant. Now sometimes we think that, well, nobody will insult me anymore if I don't preach, you know, if I just go hide off somewhere. Sometimes I think like that. Maybe I'll just hide somewhere. And nobody will criticize me. But no, but Narada Muni's going right out there, right in Daksha's face. Right, and taking all his insult, and he's tolerating. And you notice that he's not reciprocating. That's our tendency, isn't it? You're this, you're that. Oh, really? Well, you're this and you're that too. So Narada isn't doing that. Although he certainly could. He could say, wait a minute, you know, who's really the empowered representative of God around here, you or me? But he doesn't react like that. He's just compassionate to Daksha. He's not seeing him as an enemy. Okay, that's a little side tangent. Now we're going to concentrate here on debt. Rinna. Debt's a nasty thing. It's So right now I'm sure that everyone's aware that the world is having a financial crisis. Where did that come from? So I read the other day a little story that explains it very nicely. So Sally's running a bar or a pub. What do you call it here? Bar or pub? You know what I'm talking about. Okay. So Sally's running a pub and she's making some money, but she thinks, you know, I can make a lot more money if I extended credit to my customers. Now, unfortunately, the customers that drink the most alcohol are the alcoholics, and most of them, because they're alcoholics, are unemployed. And therefore, they can't buy as much liquor as she would like to sell them. So she decides that she's going to extend credit to the unemployed alcoholics who come to drink at her bar. So naturally, then, they drink more. And they start amassing a huge debt. And then she thinks, wow, they're drinking so much, I could raise the price of the most popular drinks, which were wine and beer. So she doubles the price of the wine and beer, which she's, of course, selling on credit. Now, because she's selling everything on credit, in order to remain solvent, she has to get a loan from a bank. So she goes to the bank and asks for a loan, and she shows them all the credit vouchers from these unemployed alcoholics, who owe her now a tremendous amount of money, because not only are they drinking more alcohol, they're drinking alcohol at inflated prices. So the bank officer sees that she's got all these assets, right? All these credit vouchers. So he loans her a lot of money, considering that he could always collect on the assets. Then these are now his assets. He now owns these assets, all these uncollected debts of the unemployed alcoholics. You with me? You following me? He owns these. And they're very valuable. Right? They're worth millions of dollars. So he starts trading them internationally. And, of course, nobody knows exactly what he's trading. You know, he's calling it wine sat and beer sat. And nobody really knows what these things are. And they're trading them, and as they're trading them, they're bidding higher and higher and higher for them. And pretty soon, different people are owning them. And they look at their bank account, and they've got $100,000 in the bank or $200,000 in the bank. That really is just all these assets that they've traded from this banker. And one day the banker decides, you know, it's nice to have this on paper, but I think I'd like to get the cash. So he goes to Sally and he said, could you start paying off your loans, please? Could you please collect from your people? So, of course, she goes to collect from the unemployed alcoholics, and she's not able to collect. And because she's not able to collect, all of the banker's assets lose value, and all of a sudden people who had, you know, in their bank statement it said they had $200,000, now they only have $20,000. That makes sense to you? That's what happened. So people took out loans that they couldn't pay. They bought things they couldn't pay for. They bought homes they couldn't pay for. The values of the homes were greatly inflated, 2-3 times what they were worth, and people couldn't pay back their debts. And because of that, then their suffering is spread everywhere. It's really horrible. My point is, it's really horrible when people can't pay back their debts. You know, when they don't admit, look, I'm an unemployed alcoholic, I can't possibly pay this. So why do people accrue debts? Generally. To accumulate things that they can't pay for. Now, that's generally in the category of greed. Trividam narakashetam, dwaranasam latna, kamakoros tatamavas, tasmane, twatpayam project. And of the three, lust, anger, and greed, greed is never satisfied. Anger can be satisfied. That's what Narada was hoping for here. The doctor will go, you sinful you, asadun, and then he'll be satisfied and his anger will be finished. I mean, of course, it comes back again, but at least temporarily it's finished. Lust also. But greed never. You get something and immediately you want more or better. Right? What was that lady, Marcos in the Philippines with like 15,000 pairs of shoes?
A million Marcos.
So that's what greed is. How are you ever going to wear 15,000 pairs of shoes? So greed is also mean, I can't get something right now. I can't get it honestly. So I'll borrow the money. Of course, modern society is set up so that to buy a house, you almost have to borrow money. But in general, debt should be avoided. Chanakya Pandit said, a happy man is someone who doesn't have to travel to go to work and who has no debt. And he also said, three things should be stopped immediately. Disease, fire, and debt. And Prabhupada talks about compounded interest. You know about compounded interest? When you borrow money, you don't just have to pay back the money. You have to pay back the money plus interest. And then that interest often gets compounded, so you're paying interest on the interest. Prabhupada said karma is often like this. If you don't pay back your karmic debts, then next life you're paying them back with compounded interest. So debt should be avoided. And then we may ask, well, wait a minute. It doesn't seem like you can avoid debt. Because Krishna set up the material world such that the moment you're born, especially it says here as a brahmana, as a high-class person, boom, you have debt. Even just an ordinary child is in debt. Without the care of the parents and the family, the child will die. Right? Oh, what are these little children doing for their parents right now? I mean, obviously they're entertaining them. But they're not really contributing a whole lot at this point. Right? Child usually has to be at least about 10 or 11 before they really start contributing anything substantial. In modern society, we don't expect people to contribute anything substantial until they're like 22 or 25. But what a debt the child has to their parents. Every child. Then what about to the whole society? And the forefathers who've maintained the codes of religion and custom. I mean, even those of us who were brought up in the West, we had some religion and custom and culture, I hope. Maybe some of us didn't. I think most of us did, didn't we? That had been maintained by our ancestors for generations, and then the saintly persons who were giving us the scriptures, what to speak of the demigods. And Krishna says, without, I was just speaking about this last Sunday, that without sacrifice you can't be a Krishna. Was saying the same thing, don't you say? I don't have the Gita here with me, but same thing in the third chapter. He says, without sacrifice you can't be happy, lokayor upayor, in this life or the next. You must perform sacrifice, you're in debt. So why is Krishna set up this world this way? That even if you don't want to have any debt, even if you have no greed, and you only buy what you can afford to buy right now, you never borrow money, someone does something to you, immediately you pay, still you're in debt. Of course, he's also given means to pay back that debt. He says, especially the high-class person, he pays off the debt through a period of brahmacharya life, through performing yajnas, and through having children. In these three ways, he pays off his debt. But he's set it up like this because the living entity who comes to this material world has a desire to be a thief. We have the desire to take the energy of God and use it for our own purposes. That's our desire. It's like this morning I was listening to Prabhupada tell the story. That's when Draupadi meets Krishna's queens at Kurukshetra, and they're each telling how they married Krishna. So when Krishna marries Lakshmana, and that's not described, it's described very briefly in Krishna marrying the five queens in that chapter. But when he marries Lakshmana, he pierces this target. It's a fish up at the ceiling, like with Draupadi, except it's covered by a cloth. So he pierces the fish right in the right point. The other warriors, a lot of them couldn't even lift up the bow or string the bow, and some of them could string the bow, but they couldn't hit the fish. And Arjuna hit the fish, but not in the right place. That was interesting. Lakshmana was glorifying Arjuna to Draupadi. She's saying, yeah, he almost made it, you know. And then Krishna hits it right in the right place, and as Lakshmana is coming out, she's describing herself. She's in such ecstasy. She's describing all the curling hair was around my head, and my ankle bells were tingling, and then I garlanded Krishna with a golden necklace. And as Krishna is taking Lakshmana, all these other people who wanted to win her, they all become envious. Same with Rukmini. When Rukmini's coming out of the palace, out of the temple, rather, after she's worshipping Durga, all these princes and kings see her, and they're all lusting after so much that they're falling off of their horses. They're falling out of their chariots. Of course, ordinary people desire that also. An ordinary man, he wants to marry a woman so beautiful and so qualified. The same thing that when he walks down the street with her, people go,
"Whoa, look what you have."
Women the same way, they want to marry some handsome rich guy they can show off to their friends. Right? Maybe in the Hare Krishna movie it's a little different. You want to marry the big Madonna player or something like that. But I mean, everybody, they want to show off, you know, look what I have. Look what I have. So we're envious of Krishna. We're looking at Krishna, not thinking, "Wow, how wonderful. Wow, how wonderful. The Krishna's married with me." We're like those princes and kings who are going, "No, I want her. I want her. I want Krishna's opulence." Ravindra Sukhu just wrote a wonderful essay about this on his blog. He was saying how that Ravana is like this. You know, he's wanting Sita to enjoy for himself. And really, Sita, the Lord's consort, she embodies all of the Lord's opulences and powers. So we're here because we're thieves. Therefore, we need to be reformed. And a reformed thief needs to learn how to do what? Pay for things. To be honest. So Krishna's put us in a situation where, in order to live, we have to pay for things. You have to pay for things in the spiritual world. Kama, Vriksha, Laksha, Patesha. You just ask the trees. You just ask the dust. "Hey, can I have a mango from Krishna?" Why? Because you're not a thief. Isn't it? If a friend of yours comes in your house, you know, and there's a fruit plate lying on the table, they can just take some if they're really close friends. Right? But if a thief comes in your house, that's a little different. "Hey, what are you doing? You can't take that. You've got to pay for it." So Krishna's training us to pay for things. And he's setting up a system where without paying for things, you can't be happy. Why? Because you're always in anxiety. Who's going to catch me? Who's going to catch me? The debtor is always in anxiety. If any of you are in debt, or if you've ever been in debt, if you know someone who's in debt, you'll know that they're always in anxiety. I had some friends who recently, thank you, Krishna, got out of a very big debt that they couldn't pay. And while that debt was on their head, they were always in anxiety. "How am I going to pay this debt? How am I going to pay this debt? How am I going to pay this debt?" So we're constantly in anxiety. And when you're in debt, you know, what is the person you really don't want to see? Your creditor. The people in this world, they don't like seeing God. They don't like talking about God. Not like anything to do with God. They kind of try to avoid him because he's the ultimate creditor. Really, everything is coming from him. And that's the point that Daksha doesn't understand here, is that really everything we're getting from our parents, from the society, from the government, from the demigods, it's really all coming from him. It's not really. They're just the agents. And that's a very simple thing to understand. You know, no matter how loving a parent you are, you may want to give your kids a nice house, and if there's a flood or fire and Krishna takes it away, you can't do it. You know, the government may want to help people, but again, the government is not always able to help people. They don't have the capacity because Krishna can take it away. All right, so everything comes from Krishna, and Krishna's trying to teach us to pay. Ultimately, though, he's really not interested in our paying. That's not really what he's interested in. He's not really interested in dealing with us in that kind of merchant mentality. He wants to deal with us as a friend, Suridam Sarvabhutanam, as our most beloved. He wants us to be part of the family. When you're in a family, do you pay? Maybe some families, but generally speaking, when you're in a family, you don't have to pay. Your father doesn't sit you down at the dinner table and say, "All right, you owe me this for that corn and this for that bread." I was in a temple once where the temple president asked our school to pay rent for attending Mangalarti. It really was, no joke. Which was really funny because we were the only ones at Mangalarti. But anyway, he wasn't even there. But he said, you guys should pay rent for it. I said, "You're going to charge us like by the square foot for how many square feet the kids are taking up in the temple." But generally speaking, you know, among family, it's not like that. So that's not, Krishna's not, he doesn't have that kind of world. It's not like in Goloka Vrindavan that he's there as the big landlord and everybody's paying rent. And he's calculating, you know, okay, how much food did you eat? How big is your, you know, Chintamani house? How many contradiction trees do you have in your yard? Okay, what are you owe me for? That's not his mentality. That's not what he wants. So paying off these debts, that's a stepping stone. It's just to get you the idea that, oh, I'm getting everything from somewhere. I should be grateful. Now, gratitude, Bhaktisiddhanta says, is not ultimately love, but it's a stepping stone to love. Now, let's say you actually come to love. Then do you need to make all these payments anymore? Is that necessary? No. You've already fulfilled the purpose of all the payments. Done. And you might say, but wait a minute, all these intermediaries who've done things for me, they'll be unhappy with me if I don't pay them back directly. Krishna says, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. I'll settle all your accounts. Because after all, everything was coming from him anyway. So that's the basic principle. It's really not that difficult to understand. Just like in school, you have to fill out these little things in your grammar books. Did you all have to do that? You have these little grammar books where you have to decide do we use there, or there? T-H-E-I-R, T-H-E-R-E, or T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. Or in whatever language you learn things. I'm sure you have little assignments like that. You know, you have to fill in sentences. Is it is or is it are? Now, good teacher, once you can write well and speak well, do you need to do those little exercises? No, of course not. Well, if I already know, if my grammar and all my compositions is perfect, what do I have to fill out these little things for? I know. And maybe technically I had another 5 years worth of books to go through, but the teacher says, hey, you already know this. You know, you don't need to do all these exercises. And you say, what about all the empty books? With all the empty spaces in them, they'll be crying that I'm not filling them in. That's silly. I mean, there are people who think like that, though. I've met parents who think like that. Just like Daksha. You know, I used to run a school where people could progress at their own pace. They didn't have to go through all of the steps unless they needed to go through all of the steps. If they needed to go through all the steps 3 times, they'd go through all the steps 3 times. And I had some parents who didn't like that. They said, this isn't very good if my child graduates when they're 14 instead of 18. They didn't go through all the steps. I said, why should I take them through all the steps if they already know it? Didn't make any sense to me at all. But I had people who wouldn't send their kids to my school because of that. They said, no, they can't jump. So this was Daksha's mentality. Narada saw, hey, these guys don't need to go through all this step-by-step process. They've already achieved the goal. Just go for the goal. You're already there. You don't need to do these steps anymore. And Daksha couldn't see that. He was stuck in this idea, everybody's got to go through all the steps, no matter what. If Narada had come and seen that the boys were at a lower platform, he would have left them alone. He wasn't doing something artificially. I mean, after all, the whole purpose of paying back the debts is to what? To satisfy Krishna. To please Krishna, to have a relationship with Krishna. If I've already satisfied Krishna and pleased Krishna, if I have a relationship with Krishna, I don't need to go through that anymore. Someone else that comes to mind that couldn't understand this was one of the most intriguing, interesting, and heartrending characters in the Mahabharata, Karna. Karna is a real tragic figure. So he's born from Kunti before her marriage, and She was so, how would you say, upset and afraid of the whole thing. I mean, so many times I thought, why couldn't she have just gone to her parents and said, look at this baby I found in a basket out there. Anyway, she just didn't think clearly. You ever not think clearly when you're under a lot of stress? So she just wasn't thinking very clearly, and she put a little baby in a basket and put it in the river, for which she mourned the rest of her life. was picked up by some chariot driver and his wife and raised as their son. But he had such a mood. I mean, not only was Kunti his mother, but the sun god himself was his father. He had a little fighter mood. And he kept trying to establish himself as a Kshatriya, but because he wasn't a Kshatriya by birth, he wasn't treated very nicely. And he went to the arena, where he was very envious, especially of the Pandavas. And he went to the arena at the graduation ceremony where the Pandavas were showing off their skill, and he showed that he was pretty much as good as Arjuna. But the objections were raised. Well, who are you? Who are your parents? Who's your guru? What's your lineage? Of course, Kunti recognized him from his natural armor and earrings, and she fainted, at which point Vidura could understand that Kunti was his real mother. But we didn't say anything at the time. Anyway, there was Karna being humiliated in front of everyone. And Kunti didn't, she didn't say anything. She didn't say, wait, no, he's my son. She didn't, she was quiet. But somebody said something. Duryodhana. He thought, oh, here's somebody just about as good as Arjuna. If I get him on my side, and with that motive in his heart, he didn't care about Karna being humiliated. He didn't care one iota about Karna's feelings. He was just thinking strategically. He said, okay, I make you the king of Anga. Now you're the Kshatriya. So Karna, who'd been insulted, here's someone who finally accepts me. Now I'm accepted in society. And he said, I'll do anything for you, Duryodhana, I'll die for you. I give my life to you, I belong to you. Now, according to ordinary morality, was that the right thing for Karna to do? Yeah, of course. And he was fighting for Duryodhana for so many years. So then it comes to be the right before the battle of Kurukshetra. Krishna's tried to make peace with the gurus and failed. He even showed a partial universal form, and Duryodhana just said, time up! And how you want to tie up the universal form? That was his mood. And then Krishna went to speak with Karna, and he said, listen, Karna, I know that you feel indebted to Duryodhana, but I want you to break your debt. He said, after all, you've done so many things for me. I know he expects you to fight on the battle, the upcoming battle. I don't want you to fight for him. I want you to come over to the Pandava side. And let me tell you something. Actually, Kunti's your mother. You're the older brother of the Pandavas. And I'll give the world to you. Because you're the oldest. He said, all the Pandavas will worship you as their older brother. You'll finally get everything you want. Nobody will be able to criticize you anymore. The son of Kunti, Surya. And the Pandavas will have to apologize to you for having insulted you all these years. You'll be the king of the world. And Karna said, no. I have a debt to Duryodhana. So he's making the same kind of mistake as Daksha. Why are we paying back these debts? To please Krishna. And if Krishna tells you to pay them, you pay them. And if Krishna tells you not to pay them, and the gopis are there, you know, making their japatis over the fire and boiling their milk and taking care of babies and etc. And Krishna goes, woo-hoo, and they go, bye-bye. What about the milk on the stove? I love milk on the stove. The baby's crying. What baby's crying? Now you're Krishna. But when the Brahmin's wives came, Krishna said, go back. So what we can learn from this is that once I fully surrender to Krishna, it doesn't matter if there's something remaining. It just doesn't matter. Krishna will take care of Masuchi. He'll adjust. Because, you know, sometimes it just seems like this long road. Doesn't it seem like that? I've got to take care of this thing, and that thing, and the other thing, and the other thing. It's Sometimes, you know, devotees go into counseling and they go to a counselor who uncovers their last lives and then, oh, I've got this problem from 200 lifetimes ago and this problem from 50 lifetimes ago and then all this problem from this life. And sometimes devotees will even say, you know, I can't deal with Krishna consciousness right now. I got to go take care of all these things from the last 200 lifetimes first and then I can become Krishna conscious. So we should understand at least philosophically that once I fully surrender to Krishna, all my problems are solved. All the lessons that I need to learn, all the debts, all the everything, it's all solved. But next thing is, Daksha's right, you can't just jump there. He's right about that. He's not wrong. What he was wrong about was assessing the position of the boys. That was his mistake. He didn't understand that his boys were elevated enough that they could jump. But he's right, that if someone's not elevated enough, no, they can't jump. It will cause havoc. And we've seen this, you know, people who prematurely go to Radhakund and put on, you know, Babaji clothes and try to just chant there 150 minutes a day or something, and then they fall down. Or people who say, yes, I'm going to become renounced. You know, and then they get married when they're 50, when they're supposed to be giving up marriage. Now, you've seen this so many times. Like Prabhupada said to the monkeys who wanted to jump to Lanka, and they were saying, well, I think I can jump there, but I can't jump back. And so you have to actually be able to do it. So if you can't do it, then be honest. Krishna's much more interested in honesty. Raghunath Das Goswami says in Manashiksha that the biggest impediment to devotional service is deceit. So if I say, oh yeah, I'm fully surrendered to Krishna, I don't have to be nice to anybody anymore. I don't have to take care of any obligation. I don't have to follow any rules. We've had devotees who think this way. You know, I can steal, I can lie, I can cheat, I can do anything because I'm a devotee. No, all these rules and these debts, they're given by Krishna. And generally, Krishna wants you to follow. Generally, Krishna wants you to be honest and not borrow money you can't pay back. And generally, Krishna wants you to pay back your debts. No, if you say, yes, I borrowed this money and I'm going to pay it back, I mean, 99 times out of 100, Krishna wants you to pay it back. He doesn't want you to say, oh, now I'm a devotee, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, I don't have to pay back my debts anymore. But, you know, there may be some time when he says, okay, let's go. If something's remaining, no, never mind. Whatever, leave it. Sometimes he may play his flute and call for us in the middle of the night, and then whatever's left is left. Don't worry about it. And, of course, the Bhagavatam says, better one moment of full consciousness. That if you do your material duties and don't develop Krishna consciousness, Shrama, Egoli, and Kekala, and if you have one moment of Krishna consciousness and neglect material duties, what is the loss? Of course, Prabhupada does say in the Nectar Devotion that if you prematurely neglect your material duties and don't achieve full Krishna consciousness, you may have to take a low birth and burden some. But you will get a chance to continue your Krishna consciousness. So all these things have to be understood in a very balanced way. Krishna consciousness is not an excuse to be in the mode of ignorance. Krishna consciousness is not an excuse to be in the mode of ignorance. Krishna consciousness is not an excuse to be in the mode of ignorance. People in the mode of passion pay back their debts. What to speak of people in the mode of goodness? People in the mode of passion are very honorable persons. But the full stage of surrender to Krishna, then such a person has no more material. They have no more material lessons to learn. They have nothing more to learn. So what do most of us do? We work on our full surrender to Krishna, and in the meantime, we try to take care of being a good person in the world. We try to live at least on the platform of goodness in the world. Because we know that that's going to make Krishna happy. If Narada Muni personally comes to us, or Krishna personally comes to us and says, forget all this stuff, just come with me, then no problem. how we try to live in the world. We don't just live as materialists, thinking I've got to get my whole material life together before I can be Krishna conscious, nor do we artificially jump to some high platform and neglect all of our responsibilities. We surrender to Krishna, and in the meantime, work on whatever material responsibilities we have in the world, waiting for the time when Krishna says, okay, you've learned your lesson. It's not the student who says, my dear teacher, I don't need to fill out these things in the grammar book anymore. I already understand it. It's the teacher who says that. The teacher says, I can see that you've already understood these things. You don't need to go through the next few weeks. The student patiently waits. Patiently waits. I'll go through as many books as you want, my dear Lord, until you say that I'm ready. So thank you. Questions, comments? Yes.
We hear that it's not good to break family traditions, and even in Bhagavad Gita, I think in the second chapter, it says that those people that break
family traditions will go to hell.
Yeah. So it's so. As devotees, when we become devotees,
we're breaking all our family traditions.
Yeah, we're breaking them. So what happens?
Well, it's according to Bhagavatam, if you give up your material obligations and surrender to Krishna and don't become fully Krishna conscious, you may have to suffer somewhat by taking birth in a low family, but ultimately you're better off than if you follow all your material traditions and don't become Krishna conscious. And some of our family traditions are demoniac. You don't have to follow demoniac family traditions. And you can also look at what is the essence of it. I was just reading about how Shiva Ramar celebrated his 60th birthday along with a cousin of his in Toronto. And they're both from Jewish families. Their mothers, their mothers were both Holocaust survivors from Auschwitz. So they, you know, Shiva Ramar said, okay, everything has to be vegetarian, you don't eat fish, eggs, only eat garlic. But they also had wine there. You know, because the Jews, I don't know if you know anything about it, but anyway, the Jews have wine as part of their religious ceremonies. So there was a rabbi there, and he offers the wine. And they had some non-alcoholic wine for, you know, Bibi Govindaswam and Shiva Ramar. And then they offer the bread. What they do, their ceremony they have, talking about family traditions, they make this bread, and they cover it with a cloth. They bring it out on a special tray that nobody eats off of it. In nice homes, it's a silver tray, or at least silver-plated. And it's a special bread. It's covered with a beautiful cloth, usually like an embroidered cloth. And before anybody eats it, they hold it up in the air, take the cloth off, and they say a prayer. And then they take it down. They give everybody a piece. So what are they doing? I know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. But I know what they're doing. So am I following the family tradition or not? So I think it's like that. Or what was another family tradition? In my home. So every Saturday night, they only did it Saturday night. Every Saturday night, the lady of the house lights some candles and she offers the candles and then she takes the flame and touches it to her head. And I know what she's doing. She doesn't know what she's doing. If I asked them, what are you doing? What is the meaning of this? They wouldn't be able to answer me. Or they take their scripture, which is 5 books of the Old Testament, and it's written on special. It's written by hand, and they put it in the scrolls. They wrap it up like in a scroll, and then they cover the scroll with silk velvet cloth that's embroidered with jari and jewels and sequins. And on the top, they put a crown, and they have it up on a raised section in the temples behind what's called an ark. It's a structure that has doors. And when they open the doors, everybody stands up. And then they take the scripture covered with silk velvet and decorated with jari and with a crown. They take it around the temple, and everybody follows the procession. And they touch the base of the scroll and either kiss it or touch it to their head. So again, what are they doing? I know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. If you ask them, what does the tradition mean? They don't know what it means. What are you doing this for? They don't know. They have no idea. But you see in the airport, sometimes you see the Muslims, they're wearing unsewn cloth. You ever seen them going to their pilgrimage? You know, and they wear two pieces of upper and lower cloth, both unsewn. It looks like a dhoti and a chadar. And no socks. And then they go to Mecca and they circumambulate the stone. Well, what are they doing? So what are these family traditions? You know, in the during the Spanish Inquisition, the Jews of Spain were severely persecuted. And many of them converted externally to Catholicism. But some of them didn't. Or some of them fully converted and some of them just externally converted. And the ones that externally converted wanted to practice their own traditions. So secretly in their homes, they would continue their Jewish rituals. But because externally they were Catholic and they didn't have any means for teaching their children, the meanings of these rituals stopped. And you'll still see these families there who are Catholics, but they're doing these strange rituals. So you see this with most of the religions of the world. And most of the family traditions of the world. What do you do? What does it mean? Why do you have this tree in your house that you're putting little candy canes on? What is the meaning of this thing? What are you doing? I don't know what they're doing. It's all some ritual. It's Niyamagraha. They're doing so without knowing the meaning of it. So who's carrying on the family traditions? Now, of course, if your family was a Rani Kashyapu, you might have a problem. But we don't suggest you carry on those family traditions. Then you have to take sannyas from your father. That's like Vibhishan, you know, Ravana was kidnapping Sita, and he said, I'm out of here. Prabhupada said he took sannyas. Of course, later on he went there. In other words, his mentality was like that. He gave up the kingdom, his family, his wealth, his position, everything. He said, I'm going to Ram. Forget about this. So... If your family is Rakshasas, you don't have to keep up those family traditions. No, no problem. Okay, anything else? Okay. My sons were not at all freed from their three debts. Indeed, they did not properly consider their obligations. O Narada Muni, O personality of sinful action, you have obstructed their progress toward good fortune in this world and the next. Because they were still indebted to, who are the three? And what are the three ways of paying off your debts? Saintly persons, how do you pay off your debt to the saintly persons? By celibacy. What's the next one?
Davids,
how do you pay off that debt?
Sacrifice.
And the next one? Father, parents, and how do you pay off that debt? And how do we ultimately pay off all of our debts? Loving Krishna! Loving Krishna. So I'll end with a wonderful sloka by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Hopefully I can remember it. Prema dana bina vyartha daridra jivana dasa kori vetana mori. And those are Bengali, excuse me. Please forgive me. Dasa kori vetana mori deha prema dana. Prema dana, the wealth of prema. Once you have the wealth of prema, you can pay off all of your debts. Right? No matter how indebted you are, if you have $10 billion, you can pay off all of your debts. Prema dana, if you have the wealth, dana means wealth, of love for God. Bina, without. Prema dana, vyarta. Prema dana, bina, vyarta. Daridra jivana, vyarta. You don't have the goal of life. You're like, it's useless life. Daridra, poor jivana life. You have a useless, poor life. All you have is debt. Just debt. You know, it's one thing to be poor, but you're in debt, you're poorer than poor, aren't you? You have zero money, that's pretty bad. But if you've got minus $60,000, you're poorer than zero. So vyartha, daridra jivana, without this wealth of prema, just a pure life. What am I going to do? Dasa kori, let me be your das. Vetan is salary. Am I saying it right? Vetan? Never mind. Useless American accent. That's been born next life as a Bengali. Dasa kori, vetan amori. I want a salary. What is this salary business? I thought we're supposed to serve unconditionally without any salary. Dasta Kori Bethanamoy, no, I want a salary. I want to pay off all of my debts. Deha, I want. Deha, give me. Premanam, give me love.